Welcome to Roguecast, the official podcast of Rogues Gallery on Round Rock, where we talk about games, comics, and other stuff on our pop cultural radar. I'm Randy.
I'm Nick.
This is Dave.
And let's go to the show for this week. It's the Roguecast for Wednesday, September 23rd, and I'm just going to run it down, fellas. We got a lot of news again.
Okay, hit it.
All right. So, September 26th, that is a week from... No, that's this Saturday.
That's this Saturday.
This Saturday.
Yep.
Is Batman Day.
Right.
So we will have a sale on Batman graphic novels and all kinds of other stuff in the store.
We'll have some giveaways of things.
Got some giveaways. Got some free Batman comics for anybody who buys anything that day. Got some paper masks to give away.
Yep.
And possibly other surprises. So yes. Come in for Batman Day. Have a good time. Be the Batman.
And you should wear like a Batman shirt or something cool so you look all Batman-y.
And if you wear a Batman costume, if you happen to have a Batman or Batman-related costume, you'll get an additional 10% off. So, but real costume. If you come in a Batman shirt or like a paper mask,
right.
You don't get the discount.
Right. If we can get our customer Robin to show,
yep.
That guy's got a real Batman costume.
Yes, exactly. All right. Then that Sunday, September 27th, is the Magic the Gathering pre-release. That is for Battle for Zendikar.
Right.
Then coming up in October, we've got our Reading with Rogues is going to be on October 13th, Tuesday, which will be over at Mambo House.
Yes.
For delicious Cuban
House
food.
Of Mambo's.
And for Revival is our book this month, which is the book about people rising from the dead in the Midwest, but not as zombies, just as dead people.
Right. But it has creepy elements now.
It does. It is good a Halloween pick for us. So
just the right thing to eat an empanada too.
You can exactly. You can pick up the first volume of the trade. You can pick up the first and second volumes, or you can pick up that deluxe hardcover, which we all really like.
George Romero's Empanadas of the Dead. Just a thought.
And you always get 15% off on the book of the month, but if you have a rogue card, you get an additional 10% off.
As an increasing number of cool people do.
That's right. Then we have Ladies' Night on Wednesday, October 14th. That's going to be over at Palermo Pasta House as per usual. Then the next week, we're going to do Gaming with Rogues on Monday, October 19th. They're going to be at Lamp Post Coffee this time. They're going to try a new place. And and they're going to play Forbidden Island.
Where's Lamp Post Coffee?
It's over there by Hooties.
Right. Yeah. That's that new coffee shop that opened up.
It is.
It's
really
good.
It's that new Hawaiian burger joint.
Yeah, they're good.
They're going to be playing Forbidden Island, which is from the creator of Pandemic and Forbidden Desert.
Right, and I believe they've done Forbidden Desert before.
Early on, they did Forbidden Desert.
So some of the regular players might have a sense of the awesomeness of that series.
And as always, if you have a rogue card, you can get 10% off on Forbidden Island the rest of the month.
So sweet.
Yeah. And then October 31st, there'll be a couple things going on. Here at the store, Nick will be presiding over the Halloween Comic Fest.
Sure, I will.
Where
maybe
we'll have...
The Impresario of
yes,
the Comic Fest.
Yes, the Halloween Impresario. And the Impresario.
Nice.
He will...
Not really, but let's say it was.
He will... he'll be handing out free comics there. You can go to HalloweenComicFest.com to see the full list. We'll have... But while supplies last, a bunch of free comics, some for kids, some for adults, some mini, some big.
Yep.
Come and get yourself some free comics on Halloween. Right. Wear a costume just because it's cool.
Right. Well, that's cool. It's like, you know, kids are going to get candy in the evening, but we will nourish their brains.
Yeah.
You know?
And probably give them
some candy.
Brains.
And then Dave and I will be holding court down at Wizard World on October 30th and 31st.
I intend to be the Impresario of Wizard World.
Impresario.
Not at Wizard World, though.
Yeah, on the 31st.
Okay, sure.
And there's a possibility I might wear a costume on the 31st. We'll see. You'll have to come down to find out.
Dave probably won't wear a costume.
He might.
I'm not going to wear a costume.
He might wear a cape.
I might wear a cape.
All right. So that'll be that's what's going on in September, October. Got a couple bits of news before we get on to our the rest of our podcast. Wanted to mention we got the Epic card game in, which is... From the guys who made Star Realms.
Yeah.
This is their fantasy game. Now, Star Realms is a two-player game we all like, and sort of Starship Combat.
It's like a deck-building game, right?
Yeah, but it's all complete one deck. Epic is a little different, and it's not two-player, it's 2 to 4 players.
Okay.
You buy one deck, and it gives 2 to 4 players with a player, and then you can buy another deck to turn to a 5 to 8 game.
Oh, really? But just right out of the box.
Right out of the box. You can also do it drafting style because it does come with, you know, enough cards you can sort of draft out and build a deck. It's got 4 different sort of colors of magic. It's very magic-y.
Okay.
But it also has bits of elements of Star Realms. So if you dug Star Realms or you like magic but don't want to spend as much money.
Or you just like fantasy crap.
Or you like fantasy crap. Epic is a good thing to try. We will be running
fantasy stuff.
We'll be running a release tournament at some point soon. We just haven't figured that out just because it's kind of a busy month.
Yeah.
But that is in the works. And the other thing I want to mention that we got in recently was Machikoro Deluxe. which we've talked about Machikoro before.
Right. This game has kind of been a breakout hit overall for the last year.
Yeah, it's a game where you're making a Japanese village by using these cards, and you roll the dice, and your buildings produce little coins for you.
Yep.
And you're trying to build the village and get everything done before everybody else does. And the new tin version of it comes out. It's a tin. It's got the main game, both expansions that have come out, mm-hmm. and a little bonus cards in it.
And it's swanky looking.
And I cracked mine open this weekend at a game night, and yeah. we played, and I introduced a few people to it, and they were instantly smitten with the game. So yeah. I didn't play the Millionaire's Row expansion, but I did play the Harbor expansion that comes with it. And it's just such a fun game. It's really easy to teach, really fun, plays really quickly. We played like 3 or 4 games of it.
I would say, from what I have seen, it has very attractive visuals, too.
And it's beautiful. The artwork is really nice and cute. So... my son is begging me to play it. We just need a third player to play it with him, so.
I dub you the Impresario of Machikoro.
I am the Impresario. all right, so on to a little bits of news. Not a lot here, but just breaking today as we record this, Ta-Nehisi is going to write Black Panther.
That's a hard name to spell and pronounce.
And if you're like me, you're like, Ta-Nehisi? But
if you're a reader type person,
you read books,
then he is a known novelist and a writer for The Atlantic.
Yes, and covers sort of Africa issues and that kind of thing, which makes a fitting sense that he's going to write Black Panther.
Right.
And he's going to be doing it with
Brian Stelfreeze.
Brian Stelfreeze on art, which is kind of cool.
Yeah. What is the last thing Stelfreeze did?
It's covers mostly.
Yeah, I was going to say the last thing he's going to do one of the hip hop covers. I know.
Oh yeah.
I remember him doing an issue of the Legion of Superheroes in the 90s.
Yeah, yeah.
He's, I think, done something since then.
He must have.
I think he mostly moved over to commercial art.
Yeah,
now.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's kind of cool. The story does sound kind of like the kind of thing that they did in the 90s where Black Panther's country was invaded by terrorists, and it was like,
right.
they like did something like South Africa, I remember.
Sort of a little politically charged.
Yeah, which I'm not sure it's going to be my cup of tea, but that's kind of a cool thing to bring in a writer for.
Yeah, yeah. So. Hopefully he'll be up for it. He seems to have... I know Teela really liked his last novel. The name escapes me, but it was the one that was like written from the... perspective of a father, an African-American father writing to his future son about what the world is like.
Oh, that's basically. Cool.
So yeah, hopefully this guy has his comic chops.
And this is not till next year. It's sort of an early announcement. Yep. And then they showed us a picture of Red Tornado.
Oh, right.
It's gonna
Supergirl.
It's going to be on Supergirl. And apparently it's going to be a villain?
Yep. Well, you know, that would... Isn't it a creation of, like, the...
Tio Morrow, right?
Yeah. Yeah, actually, but it's for the organization... that we see in the first episode that she works for.
Oh, okay.
I did not know that, actually. I believe
that's what I read.
You mean the DEO?
Yeah, the DEO.
Okay.
Like, it's like, you know, to take down aliens or something like that.
Okay.
No, it probably gets out of control, and she's got to beat it into submission, and then it's her pal.
I saw a lot of people bashing the costume.
Yep.
I actually thought it looked pretty good.
I did, too.
Yeah, no, I agreed. I could see where somebody was like... Well, that picture looks a little bit like foam
or cosplay or whatever.
Sure, but in motion, it's going to be... I mean, you always have to account for motion.
Yes, yeah. No, I agree. I mean, like the original costumes for the X-Men movie, the original one.
They didn't look great standing still, but they look good in motion.
Yeah, it's not unlike... It doesn't look quite as polished as the Vision did for the Marvel movie, but it has a similar kind of thing, a human-like face... with a sort of more robotic body that has, like, sort of plates and stuff on it.
And I'm kind of not going to see the costume if he's going to be Whirlwind Guy.
Assuming they do go with that. I mean that's such a weird power. A robot that controls wind and, like, elemental stuff like that.
Yeah, here's the funny thing. I've never been a huge Red Tornado fan. Not in the comics, not when he was on Young Justice.
More than the execution. You know what? The best Red Tornado I read was in a writer who I otherwise somewhat avoid, which is... Brad Meltzer did some good stuff with him in his Justice League run, which was a chatty, overly written Brad Meltzer run, but I did like his characterization.
I liked him on Batman Brave and the Bold.
Yeah. And see, I wanted to like him there, too, and he was okay.
He has the capacity to be as good as the Vision, and, you know, he's going to get an overhaul for the TV show, no doubt.
Yeah.
So it just, you know, hopefully we've seen the pilot, we liked it.
Yep.
Hopefully that same quality will come through on him.
Yeah. I think more exciting is that Tio Morrow is going to be on the show.
Yeah.
Is he for sure? Did they say that?
Yeah. They did say
okay,
that.
Nice.
So I want him to be wearing a Hawaiian shirt.
Oh, and in fact, the guy who plays the Red Tornado is the actor who's also playing Tio Morrow.
Oh, that's
probably,
pretty cool.
He's based on himself.
Yeah, sure.
Or well, has his imprints in it or whatever.
Yeah,
his villainous ego.
Who's the on Arrow? You're caught up. or yeah. mostly. Who's the villain who was in season 2? It was another scientist. Was it Ivo?
Yeah,
it was Ivo. So Ivo's been on Arrow.
So they've got both of them.
Yeah.
If they can somehow manage a crossover, you know,
that'd be amazing.
There's been good stuff with like their rivalry and Grant yeah. Morrison's Justice League run.
I think the Amazo should be a boat that transforms into a robot.
I mean, it's already a boat, so yeah. sure, it can transform.
That's right.
Finally, kind of cool news, DC is finally going to credit Bill Finger as the creator of Batman.
Yeah, that's a big legal change-up yep. because...
but how many years is that?
It's been a decades. Long time. Bob Kane was in the Tim Burton movie. Taking credit.
Right.
The
little
weasel.
And I remember he was all over TV as if he was Stan Lee
yep.
at the time. And so most people kind of know Bob Kane created Batman.
Yep.
But the untold story and sort of, you know, I think many people still don't know this. I didn't know it really well until, you know, some years ago, is that Bill Finger was really responsible for the lion's share of yep. creating Batman's alter ego, his look, his villains. Like, it's like he created the Joker. He yep. came up... But, you know, Bob Kane's original sketch did not look anything like yeah. the Batman we know, and yeah. Bill Finger did all that.
That Bob Kane yeah. might have come up with a name.
Yeah. right. And so, this has been a long time coming, and I thought that because of legal stuff, Bob Kane was very sly with that.
Yeah.
So I guess the first time this has occurred was on last night's Gotham?
Yeah.
Yes, it's going to be on Gotham.
Yeah, Randy and I were reflecting that it's not on our favorite properties that yeah. it's coming up on. And then the Superman-Batman movie.
Yep.
It'd be nice if it was just straight up in the comics right away.
Yeah.
Are they going to be able to do that, or is this somehow
know.
Only in the film project?
I don't know.
But in any case, previously it seems like Bob Kane had secured some kind of contract where he had to be credited as the sole creator of Batman.
Yep.
And DC was never allowed to credit anybody else.
He was as good at getting lawyers as he was bad at creating Batman.
right. but anyway, happy to see it happen at all.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just, it's too bad he didn't see it in his lifetime.
Yeah.
You know, it really kind of just comes out to his family and the truth finally being out there.
Yeah, yeah. All right. Well, we're going to take a break, and then we'll be back in just a moment to talk about our previews for December. All right. So last month we started this, and it looks like it's going to be at least a monthly feature for 2 months.
Yes.
We're going to go through previews, which is the monthly ordering catalog we use. You can always pick this up from us off the shelf. Buy your own copy and go through, or you're always welcome to just kind of look through in the store. And it is a list of literally everything we get from our comic distributor, from DC to Marvel to Image to all the smaller publishers, even some toys and t-shirts and some of that stuff is in the back.
And except for like the toys and stuff, most everything in there is going to arrive at our store in about 2 months.
Yes.
And so it's a great catalog for you to look at things and say, hold this for me when it comes out.
Yep. And so what we're going to do is we're each going to pick a few things, a few favorites, and mention stuff that we think is cool that's coming out. And if any of this sounds cool to you, you can drop us an email and say, hey, I would like you to add this to my file or put a special order in for yeah. me.
You can Facebook us, tell us in person.
Smoke signals.
Smoke signals. Skywriting.
Skywriting.
Yeah.
Yeah. Go big.
Yeah.
All right.
Tattoos.
that seems like a big
Here's
commitment.
My previews order tattooed on my back, memento style.
is that the premise of that show, Blind Spot? She just had a whole bunch of previews orders on her. All right, Dave, you want to kick us off?
Sure. I'm going to start with something super weird.
Yep.
Just to get us going.
Sure.
So Junji Ito is a creator that we exclusively know as a horror creator for manga. He's like the definitive king of horror manga.
Yep. So he's got a new horror manga.
So he's got a new horror manga, which is in fact a cute comic about cats.
Well, as someone who's allergic to them, that sounds horrifying.
it's called Junji Ito's Cat Diary, Yon and Mu, which I believe are the name of the cats. And I'm just going to go ahead and read the description here. You know, his people cannot help but look a little bit creepy, even in this picture. The cats that are in the picture are actually pretty cute looking.
Yep.
But his people always look a little sickly and pale. And I don't know if that's just, like, all the time or it's because they have allergies in this. Anyway.
It's just how he sees people.
The solicit reads, Junji Ito, master of Japanese horror manga, presents a series of historical and true accounts detailing the trials and tribulations of being a cat owner. Actually, you know what? They go on to, like, just kind of sort of a specific situation. But that's the gist of it.
Yeah.
If you liked Jeffrey Brown's cat getting out of the bag, or...
Cats are weird.
Or this if by chance you're lucky enough to have read What's Michael, which was primarily coming out in the early 2000s.
Man, they need to put that back in print.
Yeah, which was a really great comic strip that both did sort of anthropomorphic cats, just kind of spoofing them, I believe, you know, especially given the internet cat love.
Yeah.
But also did a lot of sort of just cat owner trials and tribulations of cat owners. It was both cute and laugh out loud funny.
Yeah.
Anyway, hopefully lightning will strike twice for the manga world and Junji Ito will come through with it. Nick, what you got for us?
I'm going to steal something that's on both of your lists because
you
I'm
son mean. Of a gun.
I am going to go with Batman teaming up with the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
Yes.
Because that sounds insane and sounds awesome.
It sounds super fun.
It does.
I really like it. I want it to work.
It's written by James Tynion, who has been co-writer on a ton of Batman things with
Snyder. It's like Scott Snyder's protege slash buddy slash whatever.
And then art by Freddie Williams the second, which I always...
The third. Isn't it Freddie Williams the third?
It's the second.
Oh, was
maybe, they missed a Roman numeral.
Or maybe this is a different clone.
It's possible. But basically, it takes place in Gotham City, where a series of deadly raids leads Batman to believe he's up against a group of highly trained ninjas known as the Foot Clan.
Which, I hope that in this mashed-up world that the Foot Clan works for, like, Ra's al Ghul or something like that.
But somehow they've crossed over to another dimension.
Okay, so they're going to acknowledge the thing and not just smash up the world.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's cool, too.
Yeah, I mean, it's just going to be them teaming up. I mean, the Turtles teaming up with Batman, which...
I'm really, in.
How can you go wrong with that?
Yeah,
I
this
feel
sounds...
like Robin needs to buddy up with... Like, you know, who is it? Raphael is, like, the killer, right?
I mean, he's supposed to be the hothead, the most...
Although, in the movie-verse, he's the leader of the group transformed from the norm by the nuclear goop.
You know what? Nobody's talking to you. I mean,
I'm honestly,
just saying, Damien needs to buddy up with whichever one of them is like.
Well,
the
Damien
craziest.
Is Raph. If you had Tim Drake, he would definitely buddy up to Donatello. Jason, I don't know.
Jason Todd and Raphael would be a perfect match.
Yeah.
They're both the hotheads. Yeah,
right. I also see that Batman himself would, I think, have a little bit of trouble with this. Slightly, like, they can go disciplined, but a lot of the time they're like, you know, let's go take these dorks.
Actually, I would love to see a hacker off with Michelangelo and Batgirl.
See, they need to have
or Tim Drake or something.
They need to have the extended Bat family at least a little bit.
I don't know if they're gonna, but this sounds like fun. I'm excited for it.
Yes.
All right. So on my list is a book from IDW, The Rocketeer at War. That's with an exclamation point. At War.
Of course.
The Rocketeer stuff has been sort of hit and miss for me. I feel like Dave Stevens sort of did the best Rocketeer stuff.
Right.
But this got my attention because it's going to be written by Mark Guggenheim, who's done some good stuff. And more importantly, it's drawn by Dave Bullock, who was the director of the Justice League New Frontier animated feature, has done a lot of really awesome covers for DC, and has sort of a World War II bombshelly kind of style. And that guy mostly does covers. He's not done a lot of interior work, so to see him do a full issue is really exciting to me.
What else, Dave Bullock doesn't have any one single thing to, like, notice?
I couldn't point to anything in particular. He's done a lot of animation work. Like, he worked on Spectacular Spider-Man.
Right. And I always see...
Did he work with Darwin Cook, though, for a lot of
he's
stuff?
He's a guy who's worked with Darwin Cook. He's got a similar style, yeah.
Worked on some of his spirit stuff, maybe?
Yeah. Yes.
He did.
But I'm excited to see him do interior art at this era where it's like World War II, seems like a perfect fit for him.
It's a little miniseries, so
and,
it's fine.
This is when the Rocketeer has been enlisted in the war. It's because Rocketeer takes place sort of post or pre World War II. This is in 1942 when Rocketeer has been enlisted in the war effort. So I'm excited. I'm actually kind of looking forward to this.
So now he'll be officially going after Nazis.
Yes,
and not
unofficially.
Just randomly running into them.
Yes, not just shooting Nazis in the street like you did.
That was the style of the time.
Yes, Dave.
Okay. Next up on my list is a book that we talked about at least briefly when we were doing a preview of Marvel's post Secret Wars relaunches.
Mm-hmm.
Daredevil number one.
Yep.
We now have a bit more information on it. This is it's written by Charles Soule, which we talked about before. We knew that was going to be the case. I'm gonna read the solicit on this one.
All right.
Back in black, new costume, and on his home turf, Daredevil begins again in New York City as a new enemy emerges. Meanwhile, his alter ego Matt Murdock is on the side of the law in the district attorney's office, fighting crime in the shadows, prosecuting bad guys in the light. It's a whole new chapter for our man without fear, including the arrival of the Devil's Advocate. Welcome to Hell, Blindspot, which is apparently the actual name of whoever this mysterious sort of Gambit-looking guy is on the cover.
Okay.
We think.
Yep.
The sort of notable things in there are, well, naming that guy, which as far as I know, I have no idea who that character is, could conceivably have something to do
with... Blindspot. Is it Jamie Alexander from the NBC's Blindspot TV show?
I don't think so.
There is a villain that he's fought before called The Spot, including in Mark Waid's run.
Yep.
But it would not particularly make sense for him to be in there unless this was some... His son,
I mean,
his
I don't
brother.
Think they've overtly said that it's an unknown character, right?
No, it could just be a new guy.
Right. I think it might be just a new character.
Sure. New characters are a little tough, but if he's essentially a protege, then you're going to get Daredevil and the guy, and then we'll see what happens. But let's see. Also, that he's district attorney.
Yeah.
And moving back to New York, I think, like Randy, I was mildly disheartened to see him switching back to sort of status quo so soon.
Yeah, because San Francisco was—they really didn't explore a lot of it, like him being in with the mayor's office, and he—it was just sort of a—I mean, I know it was like 18 issues, but that's only like a year and a half. I would have loved to have seen him stay in San Francisco,
right? And he was like disbarred in New York. You know, I'm not a continuity fiend, but I feel like it's not going to be easy to go back to being district attorney. Or you're not going to get.
I mean, knowing Charles Soule, I think they'll address it. And remember, this is happening eight months in the ahead of time. So
I'm just saying, it's barred. Anyway, but district attorney will be an interesting thing to see him. We were discussing this earlier, trying to figure out if Daredevil has ever been like district attorney.
I still feel like he has, but I can't pinpoint it.
I don't think so.
And you may be right.
I tend to think not either. But I'm interested to see what they're doing with it, especially with Charles Soule writing, who is himself. Has he written Daredevil?
No.
But he himself is a practicing
attorney. I can't believe with all the stuff he's writing that he still
is. He showed up in She-Hulk once or twice.
Charles Soule did?
No.
You know what? In one of the more serious later issues, he was her opponent.
Yeah.
She-Hulk was the current.
That was a great run.
So that gives me good vibes for this.
Yeah.
The other thing of note is that some preview art has been showing up online for Ron Garney.
Yeah.
Who is kind of one of these... artistic stalwarts, kind of from going back to what,
90s at least,
who's never been a particularly flashy artist, but has always had like real, just rock solid as you can get.
Yep.
And I have to say, like, the preview art I've seen was above that.
And Garney can rise above his usual, like, sort of moderate workmanlike.
I think he has.
Because when he worked with Waid on Captain America, he was notably good.
Right.
So he can, when he's on a project he's inspired.
I have a feeling that Wade's pedigree that, you know, on this book, you know, that he wants to keep that momentum going of Daredevil as, like, such a renowned book.
Yeah.
And is putting a little bit more into this, or so it seems. Anyway, Nick, you're next.
I'm going to pick a crossover because I want to be different.
Crossover?
Yes.
You disgust me.
Everybody hates crossovers.
They do, but they still sell. This one actually is an interesting one because it is... called Robin War. And it crosses over with Grayson Detective Comics, We Are Robin, and Robin Son of Batman. There's some tie-ins with some other smaller books.
Yep.
But those are the main ones. The original, like, the number one issue is going to be written by Tom King. So, from Grayson, a few Marvel books that are coming up. What's kind of interesting about this is that it's all of the Robins versus the Court of Owls.
That's
kind of
cool.
And the cover on it is actually all the Robins wearing Court of Owl masks, which is a great visual, because it also incorporates, you know, Jason Todd, Tim Drake, the We Are Robins people.
That's what I was wondering, is if they were going to play a role.
Yeah, so it looks like they're all sort of banding together. It also says they're fighting each other at times, but that's sort of a, you know, superhero conceit at this point. I don't know. It just sounds really interesting. And I've liked a lot of the... I'm liking what Tim Seeley and them are doing on Grayson. I'm just curious. I'm always a big fan of Robin.
You know, they've been doing a lot of this with sort of the Robins as legacy. Like, there's a scene in Grayson we'll talk about later this week that has all the Robins, like Jason and Tim and Dick sort of talking together about being sort of brothers.
Yeah.
And I love this. I love this idea. I wish they'd do it with Batgirl. Because you'd have to acknowledge that these people weren't all like Batgirl in the New 52, but
having Cassandra,
but like Cassandra, and if you would somehow have Oracle and Stephanie all together, I'd love that. I think they did a little bit of that when Stephanie Brown was Batgirl,
right? But, yeah, towards the tail end of the pre New 52 stuff, there was a bit of that.
And I'm also just excited to see the Court of Owls come back because I do think that Snyder and Capullo created a really good villain.
I agree.
Great look. The talons make them dangerous.
Yep.
And I like to see that they're being used in other books.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's the best thing about this is that the Court of Owls is going to get a little spotlight. Yeah.
I think the cover copy should read, "It's Owl Time."
Oh, no, how about this? Who's hunting Robin?
Yes!
And that's why Dave and I don't write cover copy.
Well, I'm talking about, of course, the Silver Age Court
yes,
of Owls.
Yes, Silver Age Court of Owls.
I wouldn't mind seeing some sort of Grant Morrison version of that show or something. Yeah. Only crazy Grant Morrison.
I do find it amusing that there is going to be a tie-in with Gotham Academy. I don't know how you do that.
Well, isn't Damian going to Gotham Academy? Yeah, Damian's going to Gotham Academy.
I thought he was just there for a brief time.
I thought he was going there.
Okay.
I don't know. We'll find out. I mean, you know, they may be assisting since they are kind of like little investigatorial types.
Yeah.
Right.
But it is interesting to me. I think people have, since the arrival of Tim Drake particularly, I think there's been a general surge of interest in Robin as a cool character.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, Batman is like the coolest character conceivable. People liked Robin before, but he kind of fell out of favor in the 80s when Batman was grim and gritty, and it seemed like he doesn't need a little partner like that. Then Tim Drake, they found a way to make him, you know, kind of seem to be match Batman's cool.
Yeah.
And now I think DC is like, only like 20 or 30 years later, is like, oh, let's make Robin a thing. You know, like, let's give a little spotlight to it. And probably a good idea. Randy?
All right, so my pick is a book we heard about. It's an all-ages book, but it is set in the Marvel Universe. And it is called Spidey, number one. And I'm just going to read the cover copy here a little bit, the solicitation copy. Think you know everything about Peter Parker's early days? Think again. It's action, adventure, and a rip-roaring romp in classic Marvel style as Spidey swings on the shelves this winter. Featuring adventures from throughout the web-slinging wonder's younger years, it's a return to the days of overdue homework, not knowing how to talk to girls, or anybody really, and just plenty of danger. Witness some of Spidey's earliest tangles with the likes of Doc Ock, Sandman, and a host of other unexpected guests. Now, we've seen this kind of thing before. Kurt Busiek did a great run in the 90s called Untold Tales of Spider-Man.
Right.
And there's certainly plenty of mileage to be gotten out of doing Young Spidey. What excites me about this is that the art is by Nick Bradshaw, who's really good, and the writing is by Robbie Thompson, who does Silk.
Okay.
And who you might know from Supernatural,
Right. Good, kind of like fast-paced, good with the quips and stuff like that.
And I also imagine a lot of these will be done in one tales. And
The thing I like about this is that it's in continuity. Usually the younger reader stuff gets shunted off to the side.
Sure, right.
So it's real. It's actually in Marvel Universe. And it allows them to sort of have their cake and eat it too. Because then you can have grown-up Peter Parker, possibly married, although it doesn't look like he's going to be. But
at the very least, he's running a business,
James Bond and all that.
Yeah,
you know?
he's rather different from the traditional unlucky, basically Charlie Brown type Peter Parker.
But you can do that and then go back to his younger days and still have the classic Spidey everybody knows.
Yeah.
And I think that's a really smart thing on Marvel's part and a good creative team.
And, you know, but presumably because this is being billed as like an all-ages thing, this is also something we can put in our all-ages section.
Yeah.
Which will probably make it one of the most prominent superhero comic we've ever had in that section.
Yeah.
Sometimes kids are happy with like the Super Friends ones or the what was the Marvel Superhero Squad?
Yeah,
Superhero Squad, and those are really good books. But sometimes kids sniff them out, and they're like, "This is for babies, isn't it?"
Yep,
and
yep.
They just do not want them. They want something that looks like what their older brothers or their dads are reading or whatever. Right. And this is going to look like that.
And that's how you get 15-year-olds reading Walking Dead.
15's about right.
That's probably
I'll allow
right.
It.
All right, fair enough. Dave, what else is on your list?
I have a kind of unusual one here. It's one of the new Vertigo launches. This one's from Peter Milligan, which makes it somewhat notable.
Yep.
Milligan has a long pedigree with Vertigo, going back to Shade the Changing Man was kind of his big thing,
and that was Vertigo, like when it became Vertigo.
Right.
He was one of the founders, basically.
Mm-hmm. And he's a UK guy, right?
Yeah, he is. Yeah. And he's extremely hit and miss with me, but when he hits really well.
Yeah. Well, this one sounded like just kind of a fun premise. It's called New Romancer, and I assume that's probably something of a play on Neuromancer.
Maybe.
Because this has hacking stuff in it.
Okay.
This has the lead character is a lady hacker, it looks like, and so here I'm going to read the description, as we've been doing. Fired from a cushy job in Silicon Valley, Lexi becomes a coder for New Romancer, an internet dating app that's seen better days. To create fake profiles, she plunders characteristics from history's most notorious lovers. Using little-known writings by Ada Lovelace, the world's first computer programmer, Lexi pushes the boundaries of coding and accidentally unleashes history's greatest lover, Lord Byron. Online dating meets courtly love in this paranormal rom-com by Vertigo veteran Peter Milligan and rising art star Brent Parson, who has apparently drawn some Tank Girl stuff.
That actually sounds pretty great.
Yeah, like I said, the premise intrigued me. It sounded like kind of both ridiculous and awesome. So, and it's Peter Milligan, so I'm going to give it a shot.
Yeah, I kind of like that.
The preview art looks good, too. I don't know quite what to compare it to, but somewhere between, like, sort of the... who drew Why the Last Man?
Just
Piaghera's sort of realism and a little bit of Umberto Ramos stylishness.
You know, it's interesting. We've talked about how Vertigo has sort of been supplanted by Image. That Image is doing the kind of books that Vertigo used to do.
Right.
This doesn't sound like the kind of book that would work, that wouldn't work at Image. Like, this feels like a Vertigo book.
That's
kind of
true,
like, very on-brand for them, which is good, because they need someone to sort of reinforce that brand of theirs. And this sounds like fun. I'm curious. Nick, what's next on your list?
I'm going to talk about some mutants.
Okay.
Always the mutants.
You mean Inhumans?
No. Actual mutants. I'll talk about Inhumans later. No, but this is Uncanny X-Men. First two issues have been solicited. This is the Magneto-led team, which actually feels more like a Brotherhood of Evil Mutants book, with a few sort of darker X-Men people thrown in there.
Yeah, I see Archangel and Psylocke, both late of X-Force. I see Sabretooth. Who's the other?
Phantom X.
Okay.
And M. Monet
Sokolov. Oh, that is M. Okay. Yeah.
Also Mystique. So this is kind of interesting, just the sense that I like a lot of these characters, and not all of them work well on a team, but... who knows? And Magneto seems to be back to form. He's in a new costume that is
kind of like
his old costume.
I actually like the costumes a lot. Yeah. You know what else I like? And I'm sure you're with me on this.
Yeah, I like
Psylocke has a little pink butterfly effect of her telepathy.
Yeah, like the psionic sort of butterfly thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, and Archangel is there, which is weird because Archangel's been Angel and he's had his mind wiped. And
well, maybe he got his mind back.
Maybe during comics. Secret Wars. Exactly.
But the writer on this
is Colin Bunn. So, I mean,
coming off of his Magneto run, I'm sure.
Right. And so I think that's
probably
kind of
a pretty good handle on Magneto himself.
It'll be interesting to see him handle a team. I don't know if he's done that before. He's done a lot of Deadpool books.
Yeah.
He's been writing Sinestro, which has team elements.
He did Fearless Defenders.
That's true. I forgot about that one.
Yeah.
This also has art by Greg Land, so take that as you
Greg
will.
Greg Land has been kind of, he's been shaping up a little bit.
He's been better lately, yeah.
He's been doing a little bit better.
Yeah.
But, so, I don't know. I think just for the team's sake, I've been really, I'm interested in this just to see what it is.
Yeah.
Especially with the landscape of, you know, the Terra Genesis mists causing chaos with mutants, and don't exactly see Magneto standing for that. No. So,
you would think he might want to crush some things.
Says with the team populated by relentless killers. One question applies above all others. Can they stay away from each other's throats long enough to sever their targets?
Okay. This sounds X-Force-y. This sounds like X-Force kind of thing.
I also think, though, that the X-Men movies, the... who's the director of most of the
Bryan
X-Men?
Singer?
Bryan Singer, yeah.
Also fleshed out both sort of Magneto and Mystique and a few of the other people in the Brotherhood. So that they may be taking something of a cue from that as far as, like, these guys won't... They may be killers, but they're going to have some nuance to them.
All right.
By the way, while you're mentioning X-Men, I'm going to sneak in and I'm going to steal a quick add-on.
Yeah.
With the X-Men Epic Collection.
Oh, yeah. That's coming out.
This is a reprint of 80s material, and the Epic Collection is Marvel's line of reprints where they'll reprint segments of, like, the most famous runs from various titles... so this is, like, volume 12.
Yeah.
They have not printed 1 through 11. They printed some of those.
They printed 1 and, like, 7 or something,
But they haven't, like, all charted out as to where they'll fall, so that, like, I assume when there's downtime, they'll start to fill them in.
Right.
But they begin with the really hot runs, which I think is a good way to do it.
It is a good way to do it.
And this is a great era for the X-Men. It's from, like, the mid or late 80s. It looks like 190 through 200 or close to it, with a few extra things thrown in there, like X-Men Alpha Flight.
Wait, 190 through 200? Usually there's like 20 issues.
There's other stuff in there, okay. Though. There's also there's an X-Men Annual. There's the full X-Men Alpha Flight miniseries. Nightcrawler issues 1 through 4.
You know, that's a 4-issue mini. Yeah.
That came out in 85.
You know what's funny, Dave? This is 100% where I started reading comics.
Yeah.
Like, I came in on X-Men 193.
Okay.
And then went back to 190, because back in those days you could still find some on the newsstand.
Yeah, yeah.
So this is literally, and I remember the Nightcrawler miniseries, like the first miniseries I ever bought, X-Men Alpha Flight I had.
Yeah.
All of this is very much foundational to me, but I think I still have it. If I don't, I'm going to have to buy this trade.
I see that, I mean, Chris Claremont was writing, of course, but art also from John Romita Jr.
Yeah.
Barry Windsor Smith did some issues in there. Paul Smith drew the X-Men Alpha Flight.
Yep.
I see this also has the – this is a storyline that had Dr. Doom in it in one of them. This is where – was it just Kitty and Colossus, I think, in this one?
Yep.
And Arcade, I think, also was involved. Just lots of good stuff in here. And I bring it up to sort of call attention to the Epic Collection.
Yeah.
We've got a bunch of those sort of on our back issue section, and they're all together. And essentially, it's a neat little – you know, relatively
really great.
Purchasable. Like, the does not have the old hardcover archive prices.
Yeah, if you want to dig into some, I mean, there's like $35 for essentially like 400 pages of comics,
right?
And if you want to dig into some older stuff,
whether it's Moon Knight or like Silver Surfer, I forget who all they have in there. X-Men, Spider-Man. There's lots of good options,
but they're reprinted on really good paper.
And they are color, unlike some of the other past,
The Essentials.
Like the Essentials, which were black and white.
Yeah.
And this has, like, the Trial of Magneto.
Yeah.
It's got some notable stuff in it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so that was my little cheater add-on.
Yeah, Randy, I see how it is.
Now you get to go,
all right.
And I go again.
Nick, I waited two picks, you didn't take it, so I'm taking it.
Okay.
The Private Eye hardcover.
Oh, no, I knew this was...
Private Eye Cloudburst Edition. Now, this is a graphic novel that was originally digital only. It's by Brian K. Vaughan, who you might know from a little book called Saga.
Oh, no.
And by art by Marcos Martin, who you might know from a little book called Daredevil. It's a story set in a future where the cloud, the digital cloud, has burst and exposed everyone's worst secrets. So the Private Eye is this world where there is no internet. There is a the privacy is like the biggest currency. The police are the fourth estate, so there's like a mixture of journalism and police. And our hero is a PI, a private investigator, who digs up details on people, which in this world is kind of a big crime. He gets involved in sort of a conspiracy that's going on in sort of future L.A. And it is beautifully drawn, really imaginative, has Vaughn's usual sort of sense of humor and character work, and Marcos Martin's amazing sort of chase sequences and action and character design. This was never going to be reprinted. He and Marcos Martin said that they were going to keep it digital only. Then they made a deal with Robert Kirkman, where Robert Kirkman came to him and he's like, what do I need to do to get you to print this an image? And he said, give us Walking Dead. And Kirkman said, okay. So they're going to do a digital-only Walking Dead story on their page,
just
Panel
crazy.
Syndicate.
I believe the only ever person to write it who's not Robert Kirkman.
Yeah, correct. And in exchange, they're doing a one-time-only hardcover printing of The Private Eye. Yeah,
be emphatic about that. This is a one-time only.
They are saying one time, and they also said they'd never print it. So, I don't know. But if you want this, and you should, put in a pre-order for it. We'll probably order pretty heavy, but it is a hardcover, so there's no guarantees. And I know for sure that I'm getting this. I'm very excited to get a printed copy of it.
It's not a cheap hardcover either, I have to say.
Yeah, what was it? $50?
$49
for 300 pages.
Oh, no. The quality is there, and it's going to be...
It's widescreen.
It's widescreen style, so it's going to be kind of a different
horizontal format.
Yeah.
Interesting. It'll be very interesting, but Martin's art works so well with that. And it's very experimental at times.
This is a beautiful book. I've read all of it. I have it all digitally. I highly recommend it. I've been recommending it for years to people who buy Saga, even though we make no money off of it, because I love it that much.
And I'm going
to
buy it. I know Randy will buy it.
Yep.
And I know I can probably name several people.
Yeah.
So, I have a feeling that of the stuff that we're naming today, this is probably the one that's most vital to pre-order if you definitely want to get your hands on it.
Yes. Yeah.
Because it is a true limited edition.
Dave, you had a cheater pick. Do you want to make another pick?
I do have another pick. This one is kind of an oddball one. I see coming back into print is a favorite series of mine. It's just a new printing of the graphic novel of Thieves and Kings.
Yeah, okay.
Thieves and Kings is honestly one of my favorite fantasy comics ever. It was about roughly a four-volume series that mixed prose and traditional comic storytelling with what I would say is slightly Miyazaki-esque manga-style artwork.
Mm-hmm.
Like, somewhere between manga and illustrations. It had these, like, sort of rich borders and stuff drawn into the book. It is hard to describe this one. I can only say that I found it both sort of, like, whimsical and serious, like almost like, you know, like fans of Last Unicorn and you know, Tolkien fans would like it too, but it's got like, it had sort of snappier dialogues. I'd say like the Last Unicorn, maybe even Bone things, if you like that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to give this a big push when it comes out and see if I can get some of y'all to check it out.
They need to finish it.
You know what? Here's the thing. I was trying to remember if it actually did sort of draw to a close.
I thought it just sort of ended.
I'm going to have to check and see the volumes I've got, because I don't know if it may have sort of reached a final point.
Okay.
And I also don't know if this might be in service to wrapping it up, so I'm going to have to look that up.
Yeah.
But keep the name of Thieves and Kings in mind, and I will point it to you people who like the fantasy stuff.
Yep. Nick?
All right. I told you I'd talk about the Inhumans for a minute.
Yep.
There is a new book that is not... this is All New Inhumans number one. Written by Charles Soule, of course, but co-written by James Asmus, which I'm blanking on.
He's doing Quantum of Woody for Valiant. He co-wrote Captain America and Bucky team-up book.
Right, that's right. That's where I knew him from. Art by Stefano Caselli. So it's going to look beautiful.
Yep.
Caselli's done some Spider-Man, right?
Yep.
This actually focuses on sort of a core team. I don't know if it's just going to be the four characters, as they are sort of, they're the away team, essentially, going after the new people who have turned into Inhumans.
That is sort of X-Men or X, what is it, the original X-Factor?
Yeah.
Kind of premise.
Yeah. Basically sort of helping them sort of cope with their new powers, the new way of life. Of course, that doesn't go all that well, because some people don't want those abilities.
Right.
Because... And the human powers are a little oddball, where mutant powers sometimes, I'd equate them more to, like, Morlocks than in some of their abilities. But the real big reason that I'm kind of excited for this is the main character, or the team leader in here, is Crystal, which I haven't seen in a long time. She's always been a favorite character of mine, and actually she's got a new costume and stuff. It's really, really a great redesign.
Pixie haircut, Crystal looks good.
Yeah.
Yep.
So I'm just excited for it, but I'm excited for all the Inhumans books. So,
she used to be Johnny Storm's girlfriend.
Yeah.
And also was married to Quicksilver.
Right. Old at some point?
And I think she was
married to him.
They got divorced.
Yeah, they got divorced. Also, I believe she had a sort of triangle with Cersei and Black Knight back
in the
90s Avengers day. Crystal gets around.
I guess so.
Yep.
Not she as much as, like, say, Daredevil.
Daredevil or Nightwing,
wasn't she
yeah.
Was also on the FF for our time?
She was. She
Sue Storm
subbed in for one
there.
Of Sue Storm's pregnancies, yes.
I just don't want to slut shame Crystal.
I understand. That's a good thing.
She's an awesome character, and I'm glad to see her back.
Only Hawkeye is a slut.
Hawkeye is kind of a slut, as depicted with all his ex-girlfriends and wives in our current action figure display.
Yeah.
All right, so I'm going to talk real quick. First of all, I'm going to cheater pick, because Dave did it. Just to mention, in talking about the Epic Collections, that there is a Daredevil Epic Collection also coming out this month. This is Volume 13 in the Daredevil Collections. And this is the Ann Nesenti stuff from the mid-90s.
So it's post-Frank Miller's mega run.
And it's not just Ann Nesenti. Fabian Nicieza and Mike Barron have a couple things in here. Majority of the artists by John Romita Jr. It is issues 253 to 270 and Punisher number 10. It introduces Typhoid Mary, the sort of schizophrenic assassin for Kingpin, who also is sort of the lover of Daredevil.
Yeah, she's had a strong longevity in that world.
And this is also the one where he deals with, like, Mephisto and Mephisto's son Blackheart, and there's, like, weird demonic stuff going on.
And Nesenti did interesting and unusual stories. I think she very much liked taking characters out of their native environment. Yeah. And also sometimes looking at things through some sort of, like, a lens where she kind of might have had to do some social commentary or a little philosophizing, you know, kind of worked into the standard superheroing.
Yeah. It's cool, and I recommend it. But my real pick is Starbrand and Nightmask number one. Not because of the characters. The characters, it says, two former Avengers with tremendous power and almost zero life experience are on their own, trying to find their place as heroes, cosmic entities, and college students. What meal plan will cover a cosmic metabolism? Can two all-powerful entities share a dorm room the size of a Roach motel? Can you safely teleport to Mars that are partying all night long at your first kegger? Find out in Starbrand and Nightmask. The premise is interesting, but what gets me is the writer, and the writer is Greg Weisman.
A.K.A. Gargoyles.
A.K.A. the guy who ran Gargoyles, ran Spectacular Spider-Man, ran Young Justice.
And currently Rebels.
And Rebels, the first season of Rebels. And now he is writing the Kanan series for Marvel.
And has been proving himself there.
Yeah. Now, and he also wrote the Young Justice comics for DC that sort of tied into the Young Justice show. So not only does he have the animation chops of doing some of the best animated shows that have been done, he can write comics.
Right, he's got his comic bona fide.
So I'm excited to see him take on these characters. I will pretty much read anything he was going to write, and I'm curious to see. The artists...
If you don't know the characters, they're from a sort of obscure Marvel project from the 80s called, what, the New Universe? But essentially, this sounds like such a re-envisioned version that no past knowledge will be
necessary. Yeah, Starbrand has sort of Green Lantern powers, you know, flight, energy manipulation, sort of cosmic power, and Night Mask was a, and could enter people's dreams kind of thing.
Okay.
It's also a Batman, Superman kind of thing, you know, the dark and light, that kind of thing. The artist is by a guy named Domo Stanton, who I don't know, but whose art looks really kind of cool and anime. I'm very excited for this, and I would not have expected that.
You know, if they have a Batman Superman thing, that kind of makes for a decent elevator pitch for it. Sort of Batman and Superman as college roommates.
Yeah, that's actually a good elevator pitch.
Not a bad way to sort of sum it up.
All right, that's about wraps up our time. I don't know if you guys want to quick just run through one line what the rest of our stuff is.
I've got just a handful of other
sure, go ahead.
That I can just quick go through. We've already talked about Totally Awesome Hulk starring Amadeus Cho.
Yep.
Scarlet Witch by James Robinson. That's one of the ones I'll be curious about. Planet Hulk, which we just wrapped for Secret Wars, gets a trade paperback.
Nice.
Batgirl, the Cassandra Cain sort of assassin version. They're starting to put out though that character is not in much use recently,
they're
putting out a collection with her, and that's some stuff that I enjoyed. She was just a good kind of interesting new take on, there's definitely no other Batgirl like her.
Right.
There's a Knight Rider comic.
Sure.
It's actually a graphic novel, but it had some notable names contributing what seemed like an anthology format. Like, was it Chuck Dixon?
Adam Warren.
Yeah, so I'm like, as weird as it seems, that might be worth a look. And the last thing I wanted to mention was that there is a new Street Fighter ongoing series.
Oh, wow.
Which I forget who was working on it, but is it Udon?
It's Udon who does it, yeah.
And those guys put out some fun stuff before. So, you know, if you have a fondness for the fighting game franchise, might be worth a look.
Nick, what else is on your list?
I have just a few quick ones. The second volume of the hardcover for Ms. Marvel finally gets solicited. Yay.
Yay.
New number one, Patsy Walker, Hellcat, which I'm kind of excited for. Written by Kate Leth. Really fun artwork.
Yeah, that looks cool. Hellcat's appearances in the recent She-Hulk run reminded me that she could be a really good character.
Yeah, and this looks like a notable change-up a little bit from her character, but utilizes some of her past as well. Red Wolf number one, which I think looks very excited.
Yep.
Marvel's Native American hero.
Yep.
Set in 1872.
Yeah. A-Force number one, which finally gets sort of a rundown of what that's going to be.
Yep.
And I think that might actually be all that I had.
Okay. On my list as well, this is one that I only pretty much order for me, so if you wanted to have a special order, it's more of a Christmas, although the second volume won't be till post-Christmas, but Absolute Transmetropolitan, the sci-fi sort of snark book by Warren Ellis and Derek Robinson.
Yep.
I picked up the first Absolute. It's gorgeous. It's a really nice oversized volume, and second volume is coming out. Chew Omnivore Volume 5, that is the penultimate hardcover collection of the Chew series.
Mm-hmm.
Star Volume 1, which is a new sort of post-apocalyptic almost sort of
dystopian
cooking show graphic novel series. Single issue has been great. It's by Brian Wood. The first volume comes out from Image. It is $10. Advanced solicited for January, the Revival Volume 3 hardcover. We talked about Revival a little bit at the top of the show.
We'll be talking about it a whole lot when we do our next reading with Rose.
That's right. And finally, X-Men Inferno. They're reprinting the original Inferno stuff from the 90s, which is mostly notable for being Mark Silvestri's sort of sweet spot on the book.
Right. And for Madeline Pryor's underboob.
That's from Madeline Pryor's underboob. all right, so that's a...
Randy,
that's,
you should have thrown that X-Men pick on as a cheater pick on my X-Men cheater pick on Nick's X-Men pick.
I know, right? I should have. I didn't. All right, so that's our rundown of previews. Feel free to take a look in the store, and if any of this stuff sounds good to you, just drop us a line, and we will either put on your sub or special order for you. And we'll be back in just a few moments to talk about the comics that are coming out this very week. We are talking comics for Wednesday, September 23rd, and Gentlemen, it's a little smaller week than it's been the last few weeks.
Yeah, well, it was when we were pulling books, I kind of enjoyed it because we had fewer subs to pull and we were able to get done nice and early.
Yeah, but there's still stuff out there this week.
Yeah, absolutely.
And notably for you, Dave, a familiar friend.
Familiar friend, Astro City. Although not an issue I particularly expected to grab me as much as it did. It has a guest artist who I liked but didn't love, so the art was not that huge draw for me. It has sort of a... I don't even know quite how to describe this artist. It's sort of like sketchy and Sam Keith-y. And
who's the artist?
So I don't know. Like, I'm going to have to look it up, and it's not on the front page.
What?
I don't know who the artist is. Some guy. Infernar.
Joe Infernari. Oh, yeah, I love his stuff.
Really? Who?
Yeah.
Who on earth is that?
He's done some stuff for Oni. He's done a webcomic.
He didn't do Four Eyes, did he?
No, that's somebody else. But he has done stuff with Joe Kelly.
Yeah.
Yeah, Infernari's great. Okay. I like his stuff.
Yeah, no, I liked it. It was just, it's a change up from almost every issue of the series has otherwise been drawn by
Brent Anderson.
But this, and it's a character I wasn't sure I would have any interest in. I believe her name is American Chibi.
Okay.
That is a character who's sort of like a little sort of star-spangled looking chibi character. She looks sort of like Powerpuff Girls.
Yeah.
She looks like a sort of a Powerpuff Girl brought to life. But this tells her origin and actually wraps up a really neat story around her. It sort of begins with... creatures from a video game are coming to life and, rampaging through the world, and Astro City heroes are fighting them.
And only Adam Sandler and Peter Dinklage can stop them.
Don't even bring that up. I don't even want to hear it. That movie actually could have been good.
I know.
Damn it.
I know.
Anyway, what emerges is her potential link to this video game and a sort of a secret origin for her that is actually really pretty cool and made the character work a lot better than I thought it would in my eyes. And it is sort of an homage to those, like, the X-Babies story.
Yeah, okay.
Or, if you will, like Kitty's Fairy Tale, one of the great whimsical versions, reimaginings of heroes from way back from the 80s.
Yeah.
Because the Astro City heroes do get pulled into a video game and turned into, like, sort of little chibi versions of all of themselves. So it is both entertaining, but like a lot of Astro Cities, there is like sort of a serious heart, some bite to it, you know. Mm-hmm. So that it is not it is not just some throwaway kind of gimmick story, and it won me over.
Nice.
It's not a really great one for honestly for first time readers. There's certainly I was just stuck with the first volume.
Yeah.
But it was another good read and a reminder that this should be on people's radars.
Okay, Nick.
I am going to pick Grayson number 12. Like I mentioned in the previous segment, the Robin War really interests me. The Dick Grayson has always been a favorite, Nightwing. But Tom King and Tim Seeley have done some really great work with the character.
Is this sort of a new arc, by the way?
It kind of starts a new arc.
This is a jumping on point.
Basically, it kind of follows Tim... Dick Grayson being a little homesick.
This is a status quo change because he was presumed dead.
Right.
Like they faked his death.
The world at large thinks he's dead.
Yeah.
Well, he's homesick. He misses his family. So it's sort of his return to Gotham and sort of having to deal with the kind of not only his status quo change and seeing some of his family members, but also the status quo with Bruce.
Yeah.
Sort of.
Does he meet Chappie Bat?
No, Chappie Bat is nowhere to be seen.
I mean, Bruce is around, we know, but he is a bit of a changed man.
What I thought was interesting is that this was him going back to have to tell people, hey, I've been alive, but I haven't told you, and the people reacting to that in sort of anger or being disappointed in him or whatever else.
Sort of an emotional reveal.
Yeah.
It is. And I think that's really brought to the table, and the thing that got me the most is the reaction that Damian has to him.
That was fun.
I mean, Morrison wrote them, sort of their relationship's one of the best.
Yeah, they were close.
They were
partners.
They were brothers.
Right.
And it was interesting to see that. There is an overarching reason why he's returning, and it sort of culminates at the end, which is pretty awesome. But it's really all about seeing the characters interact, and I think it's done really, really well.
I only flipped through this. I have not read it yet, but the regular artist is Mikkel Janin.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yep. And I was like, every time I look, I'm like, oh my god, this guy is good.
Yeah.
Yep. Now, he draws action so well.
His character designs are so mm-hmm. good, too. Like, his faces and stuff are really memorable.
It's just very slick. Another great issue of Grayson, and I can't wait to see what
first year it looks like.
Can't wait to see what comes next.
All right, my pick is the final issue of the Secret Wars book Runaways, number 4. This has been a really fun book. I was skeptical of Runaways because Runaways to me is the main characters that Vaughn created.
Yeah,
and I've never seen anybody but Vaughn really write them properly. So this version is they're running away from Doom's sort of academy in Secret Wars, and they've been out. They were running a different worlds, different territories, and this is them coming back to the school, having to face their friends who maybe they were on the other side with, and try and take down the school. And this is it's got Amadeus Cho, it's got Delphine from the Hercules run, it's got Cloak and Dagger. It's a really great use of Molly, a.k.a. Princess Power from Runaways. And it's just, it's fun and sweet, and there's all this relationship stuff going on. There's a relationship between Jubilee and another character that I was not expecting. There's a really great turn for the Winter Soldier, who is sort of the big upperclassman enforcer of the whole thing. And it's just, it's a really great wrap. This is a good standalone story that I would love to see them somehow continue. I don't think there's any way the continuity will work where they could keep going. But I wound up liking this. This might have risen in my estimation to be one of my favorite Secret Wars book at the end.
Was it on your top 10 when we did that?
I don't know if it was. I don't think it was. But this ending sort of brought it up for me. And it's got really nice art, too.
You can definitely do that.
By Sanford Green and Noelle Stevenson, who you might know from Lumberjanes. She's also the writer.
Huh.
Really fun, and if you're a Lumberjanes fan, I would definitely recommend it. If you like the old Runaways or like Miss Marvel, it's in that ballpark. So definitely worth a look. I was very pleased with. Also on my stack this week, I think the final 50 Years of S.H.I.E.L.D. one shot. Maybe there's one more.
I think there might be one.
This is Fury number 1, which is basically it takes Nick Fury Jr., the sort of black Nick Fury who has basically been retconned to be Nick Fury's son. And through a quick bit of time travel, sends it back to the 1960s during the Watts riots, where he interacts with Nick Fury and Dum Dum Dugan and Gabe Jones.
Oh, interesting.
And it's got a lot of sort of racial overtones to it, but it also deals with sort of the relationship between Nick Fury and his father. They do a fun thing where they're like, there are time travel protocols where he's instantly able to establish his bona fides that I am from the future, I can't tell you anything. And Nick Fury in the past buys into this because it's the kind of thing he would do.
Right.
And it's kind of fun that they do the time travel without getting too messy in the time travel. And it's by David Walker, who's been doing Cyborg and who did Shaft over at Dynamite. And artist by Lee Ferguson, really nice. Just a little fun one-shot. It is one of the weaker S.H.I.E.L.D. ones, but that's just because most of the S.H.I.E.L.D. ones have been really, really good for me.
Right.
Worth a look. And then Star Wars Canon number 6 is sort of an epilogue to the first story. Jumps over so you see all the other Rebels characters with him as they return back to the planet where most of the previous story took place.
So this one is contemporary with Rebels?
Contemporary with Rebels, yes. But it flashes back a lot to what has been going on in the Canon stuff. The Avatar The Last Airbender stuff starts up again. There is a new Volume 1. This is Part 1 of Smoke and Shadow. And it involves... says that Zuko discovers not everyone in the Fire Nation celebrates their homecoming, believing the young Fire Lord is not fit to succeed his father, and spurred on by the Kemurakagi, menacing spirits long thought to only be myths, an underground organization called the New Ozai Society plots to assassinate Zuko and restore Ozai to power. If you've read any of these, you know that Jean-Lun Wang has just a great handle on the characters, and the art by Gorihiro is always nice.
Yep.
There is an adaptation of Philip Pullman's The Golden Compass, which was sort of the atheist version of Harry Potter, basically.
Right, or
there's
Narnia.
There's steamships, and there's an alternate world, and there's, magic and polar bears and all kinds of cool stuff.
It sort of tanked when they did the film adaptation.
The film was a mistake,
But the books are highly, highly regarded.
And the books are really good. I've read all three. I really like this. It's sort of a younger reader's.
The art looked great in it.
And the art's really beautiful, so definitely worth a look if you're interested in sort of a steampunk adventure novel and sort of a steampunk is probably the best way to put it.
Yeah, it's steampunkish.
Howard the Duck number 0, which collects the first 5 issues of the run.
It's called Howard the Duck number 0?
Volume 0, yes.
Why'd they call it that?
because Volume 1, I guess, is going to be the one that starts with the new number 1.
Oh, right, okay.
I don't know. This is Chip Zdarsky and Joe Quinones' Howard the Duck, which I have loved from the outset and I'm very happy with. And then finally, there is a Hellboy the 100 project, which comes out this week. It's just a little trade paperback. It has... Basically, this is a thing they do for the Hero Initiative, which is the charity for older creators who need help.
Right.
They get a variety of creators to do covers on blank covers, of this case, Hellboy the BPRD 1952. So basically, if you would like to see about 100 really awesome artists doing anything from black and white to pen and ink to color, sketches of Hellboy... this is a good look, and it is. There's some great stuff in here.
It's really cool looking.
There's some wraparound covers. There's some that are just one page. I'm looking through the names, and like Clayton Crane, I see Max Fiumura.
I just love seeing what artists do with like with a blank cover that they're given. They're like, come up with something, and you know, a lot of the you know some of them are sort of pinup style, but some of them have that you know sort of suggest a story or a narrative. And it's just cool to see what they do as far as, you know, everything from layout to style.
Yeah. Really cool. If you're a Hellboy fan and you like art books, this is a great, cheaper than usual art book you can grab with 100 different images of Hellboy. Nick, what else is on your list?
Second issue of Deadpool versus Thanos. The fifth issue of Fight Club.
Which we found out is an ongoing, which is weird.
Yeah, it's a little strange. I don't know. The fifth issue of Grant Morrison and Chris Burnham's Nameless. It's been a little while, and I kind of feel like I need a refresher course.
Right, so that's sort of their horror classic, sci-fi.
Yeah, it's horror sci-fi.
Classic Grant Morrison effect.
A little bit.
Like, I may need to read these all back-to-back.
The finale to Inhumans, Attila and Rising.
Right, all the Secret War stuff is wrapping. It's interesting.
And I have to say, it was a really, really great ending to the story.
Seems like they've of the endings we've seen, they've been sticking with.
They've been doing pretty good on the endings, yeah.
And... I don't know if Dave will mention it, and I'm stealing it from him.
Yeah, go for it.
The third issue of 1872, which...
It's really good.
Really good, but it's really dark.
Yeah.
Yeah, their Old West is an unforgiving world.
Yeah.
It is. But a lot of cool twists and turns.
Yep.
A few characters show up that I was surprised by.
Well, you know, one thing I've liked is, you know, we know Old Western movie tropes.
Yeah.
And this has played with them a little bit, you know, especially like, you know... what's his name? Tony Stark, sort of in the role of Doc Holliday.
Or yeah. Mm-hmm.
But overall, this story is not going in directions, though. I mean, although it like was sort of built on those foundations of sort of stock Western stuff.
Yeah.
You know, the last good sheriff, the big boss who runs the town, and all that. It has not gone to places that I've expected, and that's something I really respect about them is that they took the story someplace different.
I won't spoil who it is, but I love the character they picked to be the suffragette leader.
It was great. And that would be a perfect example of not the kind of thing that you would normally throw into just an old Western action story.
But it's such a great
fit.
Like,
oh, the rise of women's voting rights.
Yeah.
But it plays a reasonable and cool role in this.
Yep.
Is that everything for you, Dan?
That is everything.
I've got We Are Robin number 4. It's an almost experimental issue that has like kind of a... I guess experimental graphic style, but the issue itself is actually fairly straightforward once I got a few pages in. But it zeroes in on one of the other We Are Robins, and it seems like, I guess in the previous issue, that like one of them might have died.
Okay.
And this is kind of dealing with the fallout from that. There is a weird sort of like overlay of like some stuff from Lord of the Flies in there.
Okay.
And a guest appearance by Batgirl, and a really satisfying conclusion, I thought, with the enemy is not quite what you would expect. She's been lured out, and there's an interesting enemy this Robin faces along with Batgirl.
Okay.
So a recommended issue. I was the previous issue had lost me just a little bit, I think, but this one I was like, oh yeah, this series is really good. Then I've got a new Wild's End series. That was the anthropomorphic series that was a sort of a War of the Worlds type story about a small English village. You know, as it happens, the lead characters were like, he's like a dog and a pig and a fox. But otherwise, it was realistically written.
Yeah.
And this is I've not read it yet, but it's a follow-up to that. It seems to be continuing in that world setting. So we'll see what they do with it. And then just the latest issue of Sinestro, which I read the previous one because he had a zoot suit on
the
cover.
You put a zoot suit on anybody, you'll read it.
But it was also a good intro issue because a new Sinestro core person was recruited, and you kind of saw the recruitment process through their eyes. In this one, he has dealings with the new Lobo, and although I kind of Prefer old school jerky Lobo.
Yep.
This was a pretty interesting thing. It's like somebody who's like could probably match Sinestro power wise, but they need him to kind of work along with them. They try and recruit him to the core, and like you know, one of the rings goes on his finger, and he immediately chops his finger off because he don't play nobody else's game.
Okay.
And he's like, I'll work for you, but I'm not a member of your core. Anyway, there's some interesting twists and turns in it. I've just kind of randomly been picking up Sinestro lately. Colin Bunn's still writing it, and it's been good.
Cool. So
that's my list.
All right, that wraps up comics for us this week. We'll be back in just a moment to talk about some TV shows and movies and another podcast. All right, so as per usual, Nick, you went to the movies.
I went to the movies, yes, several times over this weekend.
Prove it.
I mean, I've got ticket stubs somewhere, probably stuffed in a pocket.
Yeah, conveniently don't have them right now.
Wait, are we going to do the new skepticism now?
Yeah, we're going to.
All right.
Today, Nick is being...
Let's grill him. I'm going to hit the hot lights.
So, I saw two movies. I saw Black Mass.
Yep.
With starring Johnny Depp.
As Whitey Bulger.
As Whitey Bulger and a host of other actors that you're right. Like, oh my God, I know them from that one movie. There are tons of character actors that I'm just like, they're all good. But this is a true crime story about Whitey Bulger, who basically at one point got away with most anything that he wanted to because of his connection sort of to a FBI higher up.
Right.
Primarily a hitman, right?
He was basically a mob boss.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, basically what he did he informed basically on another mob, like the Italian mob, to get them out of where he was living, in New York.
And what was it? The FBI guy sort of had a weird, like, childhood friendship or hero worship.
But his childhood friendship.
But he also was like using him as a source, right?
Yes, sort of.
Right. Although Bulger wasn't actually giving him anything.
No, not at all. It was basically just sort of he kind of worshipped the ground he walked on a little bit, or at least that's what the movie portrayed.
Yeah.
It as.
Okay.
I mean, the big thing for this one is just the Johnny Depp's performance as Whitey Bulger.
Yeah, because he transforms himself.
Yeah,
he looked really good.
He is very intense. He deserves all the acclaim that he's been receiving. I think the movie overall is just good.
Yeah.
His performance sort of elevates it a little bit because he is just so monstrous and so sort of despicable. But he's charismatic at the same time.
Right.
Benedict Cumberbatch actually plays his brother, who is a sort of mayoral candidate. And it was interesting to hear Benedict Cumberbatch sort of put on that sort of Jersey-ish accent. He falls right into it.
He did all right?
Oh, yeah. No, I mean,
the UK guys and the New Zealanders and the Aussies all seem pretty good at doing the American.
So this was East Coast? I was thinking this was in Boston.
Is
it not?
You know, actually, it might have been
History of South Boston.
Boston. But yeah, no.
I know there's a big book that was based on, directed by Scott Cooper,
which I didn't recognize.
Crazy Heart and Out of the Furnace.
Oh, so, well, Crazy Heart is a notable thing. That was Jeff Bridges' sort of biopic about. I'm going to blank on the guy's name, but that was up for a lot of awards. So this guy definitely is sort of a crowd pleaser or a Oscar pleaser kind of guy.
Right. Right.
And I know there have been talks about Johnny Depp finally getting sort of an Oscar nod for it.
That's interesting.
The other movie I saw was Maze Runner, The Scorch Trials.
Yep.
Which, okay, just right off the bat, it's a young adult novel series. So, yeah,
but,
I mean,
you know, so is Harry Potter, so is The Hunger Games.
But, I mean, it sort of falls in line with The Hunger Games and Divergent.
Yeah.
A lighter sort of take on a dystopia.
It's definitely a dystopian.
Does it bother anyone that we're prepping all our teenagers for a dystopian future?
No, and I'll tell you why.
Okay, yeah.
Because that's what I thought I was going to get in the 80s. Only I was watching adult dystopias like Mad Max and 1984.
Yeah.
And
The Day After.
The Day After and all the stuff that scared the shit out of me. I feel like kids think it's going to be too romantic.
Yeah, you're right.
This is definitely not romantic. This actually paints a pretty horrific picture of what the world could be.
But somebody falls in love, don't they?
No, and that's kind of the weird thing. There's not really a romantic undertone.
Yeah, I'm kind of surprised.
And that's kind of interesting. And sort of the world where basically something has occurred, there's a plague that's been released, most people are not immune to it, but a few people are. There's a group called Wicked, which
puts on a Broadway show.
Yes, of course. No, but they're sort of looking for a cure and find it in a group of kids and young children. Basically, there's something in their blood that has the ability to sort of not become immune, but it's kind of like a halfway cure.
Or resistant or whatever.
Yeah, or resistance. And they're immune. So they're put in, like, these mazes, which I don't exactly... could never figure out exactly what the mazes were supposed to do.
Well, you know, you do clinical trials on mice.
Yes.
You put mice in mazes. Mm-hmm. So therefore, if you're going to do clinical trials, you have to have mazes.
I mean,
I actually expect that was probably part of the
thing. I mean, that's not unlike what it is. I mean, it's very much scientific exploration of trying to find out this cure. But you follow this group of kids, well, you know, roughly about 16 to... 17, 18.
Okay.
They're pretty good actors. I mean, the one that I recognize the most is the kid who played from About a Boy.
Yeah.
Okay. I can't remember his name. He's really good. And it's just them sort of, as they escaped at the end of Maze Runner, they've escaped into the world, and it's sort of them finding their way now.
Is there another maze?
No, there's no maze. Oh. This is the Scorch Trials, where they're traversing the sort of Badlands, essentially. Okay.
By the way, the maze, was it like a technological thing, or...
Well,
I was trying to figure out if it was some kind of weird thing, like in, what was that Harlan Ellison story, I Have No Mouth and I Must Scream?
Yeah.
Which was like this weird underground mega computer complex.
Well, it was weird. It was basically like this Eden, this glade that, you know, basically Lord of the Flies, they didn't have a lot of, like, rations. They were given rations, like, once a month or something, but every night... A door would open and sort of this always changing maze would be sort of open to them. Uh-huh. And they had what they called maze runners, which are sort of a select group of people who were like the fastest of their group.
Right, right.
And they would traverse it and try to map it, looking for a way out. Again, I don't know what that has to do with finding a cure for something, but you just kind of roll
the dots
with it.
Connect or something somewhere.
And this one, you get to see more of Wicked and the sort of villainy. I will tell you, the guy who plays sort of the main antagonist is God from Game of Thrones. The
Sean Bean.
No.
Peter Dinklage.
No, it's the Lily guy Hattie. who plays the sort of woman. God, I can't even think
of his name. Describing. I'll keep guessing.
crap, I can't even think of his
name. Yep. Somebody from Game of Thrones. Yes. Jon Snow.
Not Jon Snow.
One of the direwolves.
Yes, it was a direwolf. The money handler from the coin guy.
I don't know who you're talking about.
Okay. Well, anyways, he's a despicable person on Game of Thrones, and I'm going to immediately after the end of this recording remember who it is, and I'm going to be like, ah, crap.
Is it Aidan Gillen? The guy who was, you're talking about Littlefinger.
Yes, Littlefinger.
Yeah.
He, again, plays a despicable person in this.
Yep.
You
will also see him on The Wire when you get there.
Oh, really?
Yep.
Okay.
He's great in The Wire.
I mean, he's an amazing actor.
I also see that Giancarlo Esposito, late of the TV show Revolution, and of course Breaking Bad is in there.
Yeah, there's actually a lot of people in this movie as well.
And a lot of direwolves.
Overall, not an amazing film, but a very entertaining film, in the sense that you can just turn your brain off, enjoy. There's some zombie-esque type things that occur. And some great action pieces. So.
Well, I'm happy to see kids are kind of getting creeped out more than being shown in like.
I saw it at a regular theater. We just on a whim saw it,
yeah.
And dear God, it was full of teenagers, and they were freaking out.
My 12-year-old has already passed it. She's already bored with all this stuff.
Really?
She won't do Hunger Games. She won't do Maze Runner. She's done. Yeah.
All right.
It's too. My 12-year-old's a hipster somehow. I don't know what happened.
What did you do wrong?
In her 20s, she's going to go back and retro embrace it. She'll be like, oh, this stuff is cool now.
Yeah.
It's kitschy. Brace yourself.
All right. So I had myself a little Bill Murray from Film Festival yesterday because it was his birthday.
I think they're doing a film festival at the Draft House.
The Draft House is showing stuff all week, which is driving me crazy. I don't have any time to go, but they're showing Quick Change, which is one of my favorite Bill Murray movies, and I haven't seen it in years. Which, if you haven't seen Quick Change, it was Bill Murray's directorial effort. Has Randy Quaid, Gina Davis, And they basically they're sort of poor people, and they decide to rob a bank. Yes. He's dressed up as a clown.
Yep.
They're inserted as hostages, and he sort of gets them all out, and they get out with the money. And then they can't escape New York because New York is terrible.
Yep.
And they run afoul of a cab driver who doesn't speak in English, played by Tony Shalhoub. Yep. And that's a great performance. It's really funny.
A lot of people didn't actually like this movie when it came out.
But they are wrong.
They are wrong. It is a fun movie.
It's not on Blu-ray, but it is on DVD for like $6, and it's on Amazon on demand.
I'll catch that at some point. I have never seen it, but from the trailers, I wanted to back in the day. Yeah. I just never got around to it.
I love it, and I know it so well. This is one of the ones I had on VHS with a couple other movies, uh-huh. and I believe I watched it so many times that I could probably get a pretty good approximation of what happens when just by sort of starting. I can start talking about it and tell you exactly what happens in the movie.
I have a perma crush on Gina Davis too.
Not so. Randy Quaid.
Fondness. Call it a strong fondness.
Yeah. Independence Day?
Where did your Gina Davis love need to come from? Was it Fletch?
No, probably The Fly, actually.
Oh, yeah.
Creepy-ass movie, yep. But you know, of course, I've loved her in a lot of things. Thelma and Louise was a you know great showpiece for her acting.
Dave, have you seen
Cutthroat Island? Is not or whatever that thing.
Dave,
is called.
Have you seen what's the one that's their political consultants?
Speechless.
Speechless. Have you seen Speechless?
I'm not. It's
you as a Gina Davis fan should see it. It
I
is
probably should.
Michael Keaton and Gina Davis as competing speechwriters.
It has a sort of an Aaron Sorkin-ness
yeah.
to it as
they,
well.
They fall in love. They're both promoting different candidates. They're both speechwriters for different candidates. Uh-huh. And Christopher Reeve is her sort of
love interest
ex-boyfriend who is like, they call him Baghdad Bob because he was like a reporter embedded in Desert Storm.
Yeah.
And it's really good. You should check it out. It is not, however, a Bill Murray movie, so to divert back.
Right. Yes.
I rewatched an old favorite, which is Stripes, which I love and realized in watching it, I basically knew that movie. Just I knew every line, knew every cadence, and yet it was still cracking me up. And then this was the extended DVD version, so they cut away to extra scenes, and then there'd be a little thing where it'd say extended scene ends now, and I'm like, I know, like I knew exactly where the extended scenes were because I didn't have them all memorized.
For the benefit of possibly of listeners who have not seen Stripes,
yes, okay,
could happen. Basic premise:
Stripes is about a couple of slackers in their maybe late 20s,
Bill Murray and Harold Ramis.
Who decide to join the army because they need to get in shape and their lives are falling. One of them teaches English for cab drivers, basically.
Yeah.
The other one is was a cab driver and he's terrible at it.
Doesn't Bill Murray talk Harold Ramis into it?
He talks Harold Ramis into it.
Like, this is a great idea.
And they go in the army and they do wacky things in basic training and they. There's a slobs versus snobs thing where their drill sergeant is not liking their sense of humor.
Right. John Candy is in it.
Judge Reinhold is in it.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's right.
There's several people
and,
in this.
Several scenes that would be considered among the comedy classic scenes, especially Bill Murray's inspirational speech.
And John Larroquette is in it as their commander.
Oh, I forgot about that.
That's a definite guy. Yeah, that's a snob who needs to be shown.
Sean Young is in it as one of the love interests.
Wow.
It's a great movie. It is one of the all-time classics, and it holds up beautifully. It's really, really funny. I did not watch Ghostbusters because, again, I have Ghostbusters. What other Bill Murray movies make the top 10? What are your favorite?
Groundhog Day.
Groundhog Day is a lot of fun.
Caddyshack.
I am not as big a Bill Murray devotee as some.
Yeah.
So like I haven't seen what's his serious one?
Lost in Translation.
Lost in Translation was the big one.
I haven't seen that, but I do want to see that one.
No. So he found a sort of a second life as an older actor in Wes Anderson movies.
Yeah.
And so last night I watched a Wes Anderson movie I've not seen before, which was very much – usually he's sort of the supporting character.
Mm-hmm.
He is the lead character in The Life Aquatic with Steve Zissou.
Yes.
Which is basically a Jacques Cousteau type thing. He is an older philandering guy who meets – Owen Wilson plays his possibly estranged son. He loses his best friend to a jaguar shark that no one's entirely sure he actually saw.
Right.
And they decide they're going to do one last mission, and they also film this stuff. So they're going to go out and do one last film of him killing the jaguar shark that killed his best friend. There's all kinds of stuff going on. There's a pregnant reporter who comes along, played by Cate Blanchett. There is his ex-wife, Angelica Houston, Or actually, I think she's his wife, but they're sort of estranged.
Right. That's like all these Wes Anderson movies are, in a weird way, they're kind of like parties, sort of like for the actors involved.
Yeah.
His, you know, such, you gotta be like a lot of fun to deliver these
things. His more rich and successful rival, played by Jeff Goldblum, uh-huh. is very much the Jonas of Twister here. He's the guy yeah. who, he's got all the smooth, the shiny equipment and all that yeah. kind of stuff.
Is Goldblum is one of his regular players. Yes.
Yeah.
Semi-regular
yeah.
players.
So is Owen Wilson, so, yeah, so.
Yeah, for sure.
This was really fun and really quirky and weird, and takes a sort of a dark turn with pirates later on. There's a ton of great music. There's a guy who plays guitar and plays these sort of acoustic Portuguese versions of various David Bowie songs.
Nice.
It's very Wes Anderson, but I loved it quite a bit, and I recommend this if you're a Bill Murray fan or a Wes Anderson fan. If you're both, definitely check it out. I have also been catching up on Clone Wars, the Star Wars cartoon.
Right. Which a few years ago, Nick and I were kind of marathoning a little bit through.
Yeah, I think I made it to season 4.
I thought you might have been. That's a thought about where I thought I was, and I thought you were a little bit ahead of me.
Maybe so.
Yeah. So specifically, I've been getting into season 2, which is where a lot of people. It's called Rise of the Bounty Hunters.
Right.
And they do these sort of 3-episode arcs.
Yep.
Now, you guys have seen all of this, right? All of season 2?
Yeah, it's been a little while since that, so I won't remember.
Yeah. So I am not all the way through. I am on the final disc because I'm watching it on Blu-ray. So I've got, I think, 3 more episodes to watch. But the first one is the Holocron heist where Cad Bane steals the Holocron.
That was really cool.
They do that awesome upside-down scene with the gravity turned off where all the clones plug onto the ceiling.
It was a little weird that Cad Bane had this weird kind of droid that was silly and
that was played. Do you know who he's voiced by?
No,
Seth Green.
Was it Seth
yeah.
Green?
You know what? Although that was a little silly, I liked the droid.
Oh, I did too. I thought the droid was very charismatic.
He was so sort of deadly serious, and he had to kind of put up with this jerky, what would you call it? Would not follow orders. What would you call that?
I don't know.
Droid. Anyway. It was a little jerk droid, and he had to put up with it.
Yeah, yeah.
I appreciate, you know, the heroes have to put up with C-3PO, and
yep.
so the bad guys yeah. sometimes do, too.
yeah. There's also the sort of three-part sort of...
Disobedient, that was the word I was looking for.
The return to Geonosis.
Yep.
Where they go back, and they do, so they pair off Ahsoka and Barriss Offee, the two Padawans.
Right, right.
To really great effect, and then they deal with the sort of Separatist leader and the brainworms.
Yep.
There is some awesome creepy stuff in there.
The Brainworms is a fun sort of horror
yeah.
vibe.
There's a lot of homaging going on in this
right.
season.
And the Geonosians in particular, I mean, I barely remember them from the prequel movies.
Right.
They were just some bugs that they fought before the arena sequence.
Right,
Didn't
right.
Also have the Sir Obi-Wan and the other sort of main Jedi facing off against like new design tanks, or is that a
yes,
later?
Super tanks? That
yeah,
was in there
the
too.
Super
yep.
tanks.
Yeah, yeah, that was an interesting one because they focus on some of the strategy that goes on in these.
Yeah,
but yeah, Dave, the Geonosians are scary bug people here.
Right. There's a little bit of like Starship Troopers going
mm-hmm.
on, and then you know also aliens
mm-hmm.
probably because they
mm-hmm.
go to their catacombs and you see them scuttling along and stuff like that. But yes. The show, in almost all instances, even though it's a little kind of all ages-y, it definitely takes these dark turns, and it takes the stuff that in a lot of cases was probably kind of forgettable or outright annoying in
yeah.
the prequels,
yeah.
and they revamp them and they find ways to make it cool
yeah.
again.
Yeah. Then there's the 3-part sort of Duchess Obi-Wan thing,
mm-hmm.
which was interesting to sort of reveal that he had a lost love among Mandalorians.
Yep.
I gotta say, I watched their behind the scenes, which their behind the scenes are great, but they talked about the Mandalorians
yep.
at length, like what they were, and I can't help but be disappointed that what they want, they came up with the Mandalorians, I feel like is just basically another clone society. It's not as interesting as when Boba Fett was originally introduced and he was a Mandalorian, it was like, oh, it was cool and mysterious, and what does that mean?
Right.
And essentially what it means is it's another warlike race.
Right. Their explanation wasn't super cool.
Yeah, so I didn't like the way they went with it. They ditched a lot of expanded universe stuff to make basically another clone army.
Randy, when they do the behind-the-scenes stuff,
yeah.
do they talk to, and the one you've seen, oh gosh, he's a comic artist.
Killian Plunkett. Yeah, a lot. He's a lead designer.
He cracks me up
yeah.
Because he's kind of like always revealing secrets and shortcuts and stuff that they use
yeah.
or kind of like cheats and stuff, and he kind of seems to take a certain glee almost in like sometimes
yep.
in bursting their own bubble, not like really bringing them down, because I mean, you know, he's a super talented artist and it's just interesting to hear him talk, but he's kind of just, he seems kind of amused to be revealing some of the secrets he does.
Yeah. Sometimes. Yeah, I agree.
I came to really like the people behind the show by listening to them talk.
There's also, there are a couple one-offs in this episode, in the season two. Uh-huh. There's the one that's actually a prequel to season one episode, The Hidden Enemy, which is the, Anakin commanding a stealth ship against the sort of spider admiral of the Separatists.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's got sort of some sort of submarine feel to it, and all right. the stealth and all that. And
I believe that is the one where I noticed was a specific homage to some Star Trek stuff.
Yeah,
and they even did like a they used a almost a callback a variant of like the music from Wrath of Khan.
Yeah,
you know because you know Star Trek tends to have the bigger, slower battleships slash yeah. submarine movements.
Yeah.
And the stealth ship, of course, is kind of not unlike the cloaked ships of Star Trek.
It was kind of cool to see a badass, like, Separatist admiral. Like, their admiral from the Republic had dealt with him before, and he assisted on going along on the mission.
Uh-huh.
And the guy was sort of a good tactician, and is sort of facing him face off. We get to see Anakin being a good pilot, which we don't see a lot of.
Right.
And it was just a really cool sync one-off. And then the next one-off after that was a nod to Akira Kurosawa. And a nod to Seven Samurai. It was four bounty hunters, Anakin, Ahsoka, and Obi-Wan help defend this sort of farming village against the biker gang. What are those guys called?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
The pirates, Hondo.
Right, and he's the recurring...
Yeah,
he's the same race as, like, the skiff guards from Jedi.
Yeah, Weequay, is that what they're called?
Yes.
Yeah.
And it was kind of fun to see that and has some really cool moments. Mm-hmm. I love that Hondo has a pet... Salacious Crumb.
Oh, right.
So it's kind of fun. And then the last two I watched, I haven't gotten all the way through, but there was the two-part Zillow Beast, which was definitely a King Kong, Godzilla and monster movie nod.
Yeah. I mean, they'll do specific shots
yeah.
and rather, you know, unabashedly homage their favorites. But that was a good one, and as you noted, Randy, rather dark.
Yeah, I mean, I was kind of surprised that basically the Emperor basically gets it killed because they want to use its skin for its armor properties, and they wind up having to kill the thing because they basically pushed it into rampaging.
Yeah, it's but that fits the source material. You know, Godzilla tends to be kind of darker stories, and certainly King Kong in most versions ends with him plummeting from the Empire State Building.
Yes, and I do have to say one negative thing, which is every time they go to the Senate, I get bored stiff. And there are two Senate episodes here, and I'm like, mostly I don't care what Padme's doing. I don't care what Senate manipulations are going on.
The Senate stuff, was that some of the Obi-Wan
there was,
and the Duchess?
No, that was actually them doing diplomatic negotiations. The one I'm thinking of specifically is there's a murder mystery that goes on. Like, somebody gets poisoned, and Padme teams up with Bail Organa, and I'm like, I don't care. It was kind of a shoddily constructed mystery.
Yeah.
And at least there's no Jar Jar in this season. Like, none at all that I've seen.
Yeah, I don't remember having a particular problem with those ones, but I don't remember them as being notable.
They're usually the ones I want to skip past.
You know, Randy, you mentioned when I was talking to you the other day that Ahsoka, who I believe a lot of people saw as the annoying kid character in the first season,
yeah.
by this time she has really come into her own, and even before this season you're on,
yeah.
and become really a pretty strong character. Like, a character where as I was watching it, I was like, so, are they going to kill her off
when yeah.
the Jedi's die? Because I don't want to see that.
Yeah. And they don't, but I won't spoil why.
Yeah.
We know things.
I think it only gets better.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to as it keeps going. Season 2 is a vast improvement on Season 1, which I liked well enough, and I like Season
and
2 better.
Season 3, I think, starts jumping around time-wise.
Yeah, somebody sent me the crazy list of here's the timeline. I'm like, I'm just going to watch it in the order it's on the Blu-ray.
Right. If you wanted to watch it in chronological order, there's apparently someone who's done that.
Yeah. It's on the StarWars.com official site.
I was surprised that anybody would bother to. I mean, like, I was a little weirded out when I first heard that they do jump around in time, but then as soon as I realized, oh, they jump around in time, I was like, okay, done.
Yeah, that's fine. Yeah.
We'll just watch some occasional stories from the past.
Yeah, that's okay.
Yeah, the whole prequels are stories from the past anyway.
Yeah.
There is a, I think, 3-episode story in the third season that is just boring, though.
Oh, okay.
So,
all right.
Beware.
I'll know when I hit it, I bet.
All
right. Speaking of going back to the past, Dave, you wanted to update us on a podcast you talked about a few weeks ago.
Right. Well, we all talked about the Grant Morrison yep. Interview for Kevin Smith's Batman podcast called Fat Man on Batman.
Yep.
And I've found that podcast more addicting than I expected to.
Mm-hmm.
I've mentioned before, I'm not particularly a Kevin Smith fan. I like, you know, I like Clerks and you know, a couple of the other movies. I like Chasing Amy, but. And I do kind of like when I hear him speak in front of crowds, which is kind of one of the things he does. He's sort of a geek raconteur.
Yeah.
And but I don't have any special love for him, so I was surprised to find how much I'm enjoying this series. And I've listened to several since, and these are long, you know, hour and a half episodes, and sometimes bridge multiple parts, but I've listened to the, let's say, I listened to the one with Arlene Sorkin, who's the voice of Harley Quinn.
Right.
That one was good. The Mark Hamill one was particularly good before that. He seems like a great guy, a really genuine geeky guy who was like a geek before he became involved in geek culture.
Right.
Before he was Luke.
Yeah.
And has like endless interesting stories to tell, whether it's about dinner with Bob Kane I'm trying to remember, like, how he came up with the Joker's different laughs and stuff
right.
like that. Like, that it was, like, influenced by him playing Amadeus on Broadway. And
right.
There's just tons of interesting stories. And I've been jumping around a little bit. I've also listened to the one with Jeff Loeb, who's not my favorite Batman writer, but is a super interesting person to hear interviewed. He's again, they're all sort of full of stories. It's interesting to hear sort of how they got their starts. How some of these guys chanced to, you know, their first comic that they bought, you know, how big it was for him. And Loeb's got some interesting stories on that.
Right.
Right now I'm listening to Kevin Smith's interview with Joe Quesada, which is a bit of a break from the Batman stuff, though they do talk a fair amount about Batman.
Mm-hmm.
But they're also talking about Daredevil because, of course, Quesada brought in Kevin Smith to, you know,
right.
when he was doing Marvel Knights, and that sort of secured his... You know, he's one of the people who secured the Marvel Knights reputation.
I mean, you can point to that as what led to Quesada being where he is at Marvel right
sure.
now.
Sure, yep. Quesada has lots of interesting stories. He's not a guy who, by any means, I think I agree with everything he's done as editor-in-chief.
No.
But the guy himself seems pretty genuine, and his story of getting his foot in the door, in particular at Marvel, is really interesting.
Yeah.
Dealing with, like, sort of surly editors and, you know, also getting lucky. He's very – a lot of these guys are sort of more humble than I thought. Jeff Loeb in particular seemed very humble sort of about his success. He credited a lot of it to luck, happening to be in the right place at the right time. But, I've been enjoying him and intend to keep on going through. Jarek, our customer who – put me on to these, has recommended, like, the Neil Adams episode.
Okay.
Says Neil Adams is a bit full of himself, or
sure.
maybe extremely full of himself.
Okay.
But is, like, tells great stories. I'm trying to remember the other ones. But anyway, I just want to give an overall re-recommendation of this, not just for the Grant Morrison ones, but probably you could jump in on any given episode if you are a Batman fan, especially if it's one of the creators you like, and I think you'll have a good... hour to 3 hours.
Yeah,
interview.
They're long.
Yeah.
What do you feel about the Scatman on Batman, which is a Scatman Carruthers taking on Batman?
I like it. The fact that he's dead makes it weird.
Yeah, it's a little
but
odd.
But other
yeah.
than that, it's
just this ghost.
I just pretend it's Jazz from the Transformers
yes.
interviewing because he did the voice for Jazz.
I'd listen to that.
Yeah.
All right, and that'll about wrap it up for us this week. Thank you for listening. We'll be back next week. And until next time,
Yo-Jo!
And that'll wrap it up for us this week. As always, you can drop us email with topic suggestions, things you want us to hear about, or just comments on the podcast at roguesgallerytx@gmail.com. Follow us on Twitter at roguesgallery. Check us out on Facebook. Check out our website at www.roguesgallerytx.com. Check us out on Instagram at roguesgallerytx. And if you want to help us out, go over to iTunes and give us a 5-star rating and a little review. We'd very much appreciate it. And we will be back next week.